Kia ora koutou. Welcome to the New Zealand General Practice Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Joe Scott Jones. Earlier seasons of this podcast focused on joint practice. This season is an opportunity to listen in on monthly conversations I have with Dr. Dave Mapleston, organised for the Pinnacle GP Network. Dave shares insights into important clinical changes he picks up in his reading as a part-time GP and advisor to the Health and Disability Commissioner. I hope you enjoy.
Kia ora koutou, kia ora Dave, how are you?
Morena tato. No, I'm well, recovering from having done a little presentation at Goodfellow Unit on Sunday, but I wasn't assassinated, so that was good.
So, clinical snippets for March. I'm looking forward to it.
Kind of a bit of practical stuff and some bizarrely interesting stuff, but first one's very practical, which is latest update in health pathways on practical prescribing. So it's aimed mainly at new prescribers, but there's some helpful reminders. I mean, I learned a couple of things, reminders for veteran prescribers. So it covers most of the general aspect of prescribing, in particular legal requirements, but some practical information I thought was quite handy to know. If you're prescribing intermittent PRN medicines, so for example, 2 tablets QID PRN, unless you order a specific amount, then the pharmacy will dispense the maximum allowable. So in that situation, it would be 720 tablets for 3 months worth. And then if you continue to print this out automatically when you do your repeat prescribing, it's quite possible the patient's going to receive excessive amounts unless they are actually using the full amount of the PRN dosage. So that has safety implications, especially if it's a medicine of potential abuse, such as codeine-containing painkillers, for example.
Yeah. Tramadol, I think, is really one to watch in this as well.
And that was one thing I did talk about in my presentation yesterday, was just to make sure your repeat prescribing protocol is robust, so it would pick up excessive use of particularly drugs of dependence. So just making sure, look, you know, that the interval between these prescriptions is appropriate, rather than somebody who's obviously taking twice as much as they've actually been prescribed and they're continuing without being picked up.
Yeah.
Now, when a patient tells the prescriber they've got different numbers of each of their medications, if you write please vary quantities for patient stock management on the prescription, assuming you're not going to electronically send it, then pharmacists can then dispense the required quantities to bring the medications into line.
Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. So much time is spent saying, "Oh, you need 32 of this and you need 48 of that."
Yep.
That is absolute gold. So you can write that into the comment section on the electronic prescription as well.
Well, that's right. Yep. So that would be okay in the e-prescribing. So please vary quantities for patient stock management is the magic phrase.
Brilliant.
Patients not eligible for pharmaceutical subsidies but covered by ACC for an injury. So these would be mainly tourists or non-residents who are covered by ACC for an accident happening in New Zealand. They may be eligible to claim back the cost of usually subsidised prescriptions related to the injury. Yeah. And there's a specific ACC 249 form, which I've put a link to. The pathway suggests that the prescriber gives this to the patient. I suspect that it may be the dispensing pharmacist that might offer it, but ideally, if you're aware of it and can access that easily, you can provide that to the patient so they can claim the costs back.
Yeah, and the pharmacies have access to health pathways as well, so you know they should be able to easily access that if they need to.
And then pharmacists, they check that a medicine or dose of medicine is correct by comparing the new prescription with the patient's medicine history. And the advice is to avoid the pharmacist needing to check with you that a change in prescription is deliberate. Please underline and annotate any change from the previous prescription.
Yeah.
So annotation of changes is important. The pharmacist systems aren't linked, and if a patient doesn't return to the same pharmacy, the pharmacist may be unaware of a change in prescription for that patient.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's really good practice anyway. The more times that you can put that, "We've made this change deliberately," A, it prevents that phoning back, but it makes it really explicit for the patient as well. What you've got to do is to make sure that next time you do a repeat prescription, you can take that off, because now it's not an established change. Because you see that time and time again where it's NB changing medication, but actually it is what they've been stable on for a while.
Yeah, and I think that again, that importance of making sure your list of long-term medications is accurate, updated and accurate. And again, I see quite often repeat medications where the instruction is, start with half a tablet for 1 week and then one tablet for, when it's meant to be actually just the standard dose that's now continuing. And just, a potentially a practical hint, there's a Pharmaceutical Society website that gives a list of all the medications not available in liquid form in general, but can be mixed up by the pharmacist to a specific accepted formula, like 1 milligram per mil or whatever. And there's quite a few of them, allopurinol, amiodarone, amlodipine, clopidogrel. So these are, if patients are having difficulty swallowing their tablets, these are all drugs that can be formulated into a suspension approved by the Pharmaceutical Society and with a specific kind of recipe that's provided to the pharmacist. So I've just put a link to that website in the snippets as well. So if you're a pharmacist, it just gives you the recipe for what you've got to add, grind it up, and it gives you the suspension.
Nice.
So on Densitron, in this case, 0.8 milligrams per mil, which I presume would be for a very young child. So that's prescribing. On to head injuries or concussion. This is just from BPAC. BPAC's best practice bulletin, issue 92. Just note there's been some updated sport concussion guidelines put out by ACC, and it includes a six-stage graduated return to education or work and sport protocol. So I think it's worth familiarizing yourself with the protocol just to make sure that patients have been given a consistent message regarding return to sport, particularly. The protocol notes that day 14 is the earliest time at which return to work, normal work or study, and sport-specific training should be considered. And day 21 is the earliest at which return to competitive sport should be considered. And I see quite variable advice given to young people, particularly regarding return to work. But this gives you a quite a specific and nicely concise and nicely laid out guidance on actually managing these patients right through from day one to return to sport earliest day 21.
So this would apply to school age kids as well as adults.
So it's much simpler than the some of the more comprehensive assessments and guideline. I can't remember what the name of the one that took about an hour to administer is, but just a plug again also for the use of the brain injury screening tool, which I find really useful, not just for sports related concussion, but it's validated for any patient over the age of 8. And designed to be completed in about 6 minutes. So it gives really good objective baseline and progress measurements covering the physical, vestibular, ocular, and cognitive symptoms of discussion. And quite handy if you end up making a referral to the concussion service to have had that performed at baseline, because they use that to monitor progress.
I mean, this is close to my heart, having had a family issue with my son had a significant concussion, and the length of time it took for him to, well, he probably hasn't fully recovered yet, but he's, fully functioning. Early recognition and management makes a huge difference.
And interestingly, there's ACC put out a statement on what we have formerly called post-concussion syndrome. So I'll read it out. It's quite interesting that ACC considers that post-concussion syndrome is an unhelpful and outdated clinical construct. Our view is that there are risks inherent in continuing to diagnose clients with this condition, not least that disabling symptoms will be misattributed to this condition rather than to potentially reversible medical, psychological, or psychiatric factors that remain undiagnosed and untreated. Consequently, ACC no longer accepts post-concussion syndrome as a covered injury. Where clients or patients have persisting symptoms that clinicians consider are caused by concussion, the appropriate covered injury would be concussion, and symptoms that persist beyond 3 months are most appropriately described as persisting concussion symptoms. So just an update in terms of, I guess, making sure that you're recording what ACC deem acceptable.
And it's an interesting challenge as well for us to, and a reminder that when people have a those ongoing symptoms, to keep thinking about the differential diagnosis and, not to attribute everything, because the symptoms are so wide ranging. that it may be a period of time when you might miss something that's significant, causing fatigue or, as you said, depression, for goodness sake.
Well, and I think there's, I mean, historically it was kind of accepted you post-concussion syndrome, well, that's expected. It'll wear off over time. But I think there's much more of an emphasis now for that early intervention because a lot of those symptoms are reversible faster with appropriate intervention.
Or you make things worse by
But not doing it.
not doing the
Yeah.
right thing.
But there's a really good BPAC article they put out in 2022 on diagnosing and managing concussion in primary care. Quite a comprehensive article, and I've put a link to that in the snippets as well.
Nice. Awesome. Thanks, Dave.
So the next one is just out of interest, in case you wonder why you see two defibrillators around a patient next time you're called to a cardiac arrest. So this is just from the February edition of New Zealand Doctor, which describes the new emergency procedure for cardiac arrest. Which has been adopted in Canada and now in New Zealand, known as double sequential external defibrillation, or DSED. So the article notes that early defibrillation can dramatically improve the likelihood of surviving a cardiac arrest, but around 20% of patients who have VF or pulseless VT don't respond to standard defibrillation. And the use of DSED has been shown to double the survival rate of these patients. So it's a minority of patients, but still a significant number each year. And what happens is the DSED gives you rapid sequential shocks to the heart using two defibrillators. Pads are in two different locations, so one on the front and side of the chest, and the other on the front and back of the chest. And a single operator activates the defibrillators in sequence, one hand moving from the first defibrillator straight to the second defibrillator. And that so New Zealand ambulance data from 2020 to 2023 identified about 1,400 people who could potentially benefit from novel defibrillation methods. And if you're doubling the survival rate, which is currently only 14% in that group, you're making some difference in to the lives of how many, 30 or 40 people. A big difference, alive or dead. So relevant paramedic guidelines are to be updated reflecting the new approach, including that if VF or pulseless VT persist after two shocks with standard defibrillation, the DSED method should be administered, and two defibrillators need to be available, and staff must be trained in the new approach. So you may be an observer rather than taking a hugely active part in it, but it's just interesting to know that this
Well,
is now in the offing.
the other thing that may come to an urgent care clinic or a foundation standards need near you in the future might be the need to have defibrillators that are capable of doing this on site or available to us rapidly. If this becomes the new standard, then we need to start thinking about A, learning how to do it ourselves, because there are particularly those in rural communities, it's not uncommon for the medic or nurse practitioner to be doing the defibrillation
But yeah,
whilst
I think
waiting for the ambulance.
obviously the training in that approach is important as well. So making sure you've got the right client that you're
Absolutely.
doing it on. So
Well, I mean, and the I suppose the other key message is CPR is, if that's all you can do, then do it. Get your defib on as soon as you can, and use what equipment you've got. But interesting.
interesting. So one to hold in the back of your mind. Just getting back to my perennial theme of equitable prescribing. So this comes out of a New Zealand study published in issue 230 of GP Research Review, and it looked at inequities in pre-pregnancy folic acid use in central and south Auckland. So the study notes that the rates of neural tube defects are markedly higher among Māori, so almost 5 per 10,000 live births, and Pacifica, which is around 4 per 10,000 live births, as compared with non-Māori, non-Pacific, which is around 2.8 per 10,000 live births. So pretty much getting close to double the difference between Māori, non-Māori. What the study found, or the survey found, was only 46% of the 400 women surveyed as part of the study reported using pre-pregnancy folic acid supplementation. So rates were lower among women who didn't intend to become pregnant, which seems logical, or were pregnancy ambivalent. And this is around 20-25% of patients were using pre-pregnancy folic acid in those cases, compared with those who intended their pregnancy, when around 58% of women were using pre-pre-con preconception, folic acid. But women who identified as European, Middle Eastern, Latin American, or African were around five times more likely to use supplementation than Maori. And supplementation was also more likely among those managed by a private obstetrician versus a midwife, and in women aged over 30.
So this is pre-pregnancy,
Preconception.
preconception.
So what they're linking is, what they're basically showing is concluding that the low rates of pre-pregnancy folic acid supplementation, I mean, definitely exist in Auckland with significant ethnic disparity, and that re is reflected as a contribution to the disparity also in the number of Maori children conceived with neural tube defects versus non-Maori. So mandatory fortification of non-organic wheat is important, but supplementation is still recommended to maximally reduce risk. I guess the message is, if you've got, any woman in the reproductive age group who could be considering pregnancy, just to bring up the idea or bring up the concept of preconception, folic acid supplementation.
I like that concept of pregnancy ambivalent as well, because if you have that, well, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen attitude, then we might not normally follow through with, okay, well, think about folic acid supplementation now, because if it does happen, then this is going to help. Whereas I might not normally think about that in the pregnant people who are coming in because and they're trying to get pregnant and they want some advice, absolutely start some supplementation. I'd usually suggest iodine as well.
Yep, pre-pregnancy, pre-preconception. But I think I guess those women who you're not prescribing the pill for could be regarded as possibly pregnancy ambivalent, those in the reproductive
Well,
period.
if they've not got a lark in or whatever, but they Great. So
But yeah,
that's
it's interesting that I didn't realize the difference, the disparity in terms of incidence of neural tube defects was so significant. Maori versus non-Maori. So, yeah.
is.
Next is really just an update, a nightmare update on medication supply issues and brand changes. So probably the most important one, I think, is morphine oral liquid. So I've done a case very recently where the patient's oral liquid, they were having palliative care. Their concentration was changed from 1 milligram per mil to 10 milligrams per mil without any discussion with the patient. And very sadly, despite the appropriate dose and instruction being written on the label, neither the pharmacist nor the GP had spoken with the administrator of the medication, who happened to be this patient's daughter. And she kept giving the same dose she'd always given because she thought it was the same medicine, and not a very happy outcome over 3 or 4 days. So anyway, the supply issue, 1 milligram per mil and 10 milligram per mil strengths now are out of stock, and the remaining supply of the RA Morph brand of 2 milligrams per mil and 5 milligrams per mil will expire at the end of March. So the resupply of the RA Morph 1 milligram per mil is expected by June, and other strengths of the RA Morph brand are expected later in 2024. So currently, it just leaves two unapproved but funded under Section 29 brands of 2 milligram per mil strength available. That's Wockhardt and Oramorph. And further detail about prescribing is available from the Heako Haringa website. But essentially, you've got 2 milligram per mil, they're Section 29. So theoretically, you're meant to be discussing with the patient that these are available but haven't been approved for use by MedSafe, but they are subsidized.
Has somebody globally found that liquid morphine helps with weight loss or something? Why is this
I'm
happening?
not sure. I don't know. There's some bad planning gone on somewhere, I think. But whether it's still a hangover from COVID days, I have no idea. But it just seems like poor planning that these sorts of crises are arising, really.
So what we've got available to us now is mostly 2 milligrams per mil. And we need to inform patients and their relatives that this is the appropriate dose changes if we need to make those.
And they're unapproved, currently unapproved, but funded. So it's Section 29 funding.
So we have to say to patients, this is a Section 29 medication, and explain that.
Theoretically, I'm sure practically this doesn't happen that often,
No.
but theoretically, that's what we're meant to do.
Yeah. Okay.
Omeprazole 20 and 40 milligram capsules. So your patients may be dispensed those monthly from the 1st of March until stocks arrive, which is expected in a month to 6 weeks. So just if a patient rings up complaining that they've only got a month's worth of their usual 3 month prescription of omeprazole, it'll be because the pharmacist has been instructed to dispense monthly until supplies arrive back in the country.
Yeah.
Estradiol, Valerate 1 milligram, that's Progyn Nova. Similar situation, monthly dispensing from the 1st of March until stocks arrive, which are expected about June. So again, it's primarily a pharmacy issue. You can still prescribe the 3 months, but they'll only be dispensed in monthly lots. So again, just being aware in case you get a complaint from a patient that they haven't got their usual amount. Mesalazine, which is Asacol, the 800 milligram tabs. There's a shortage of those expected until July 2024. So 2 times 400 milligram tabs is a suitable alternative. And this
I'm
links
sure I'm
up.
going to remember all of these, Dave.
Well, just these next two are around inflammatory bowel disease. So, olsalazine, which is dipentin, the 250 and 500 milligram tabs are both unavailable, with 500 milligram expected available from April 24. So, they're saying consider changing to an alternative medication such as mesalazine in the meantime. So, it all gets very complicated. But again, I think just being aware of what might be short out there. Probably of more significance, the funded misoprolol brand is changing from the 1st of April. So misoprolol, Mylan and Viatris will no longer be funded, and there's a new different coloured tablet that takes its place. And again, pharmacy hopefully will be telling the patients this, but there's a patient information leaflet available from the Pharmac website that's easily downloadable. Or even just informing patients that, you know, it's going to be a different colour from the 1st of April. And from 1st of March, from the start of this month, Pharmax removed the requirement for annual renewal of SA numbers for patients taking Entresto for heart failure.
Yeah.
So that makes sense, given that heart failure, you usually don't end up stopping such medication unless you have a heart transplant or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, one that I think we need to be just have some caution about is modafinil. I'm not sure how often you prescribe it.
Can't
it's the
think
brain.
I've done so.
Yeah, it depends on how many influences are saying how great it is at the time, probably. But it's the brain drug, you know, the one you take before exams or when you're trying to study. So the
Maybe I should take it more frequently.
Yeah. Well, I need to take it because apparently you lose 3% of your IQ every time you have COVID, and I've just had it for the third time. So
sorry,
I might be needing something to sharpen up my cognition. But it's contraindicated in so often it is that young student population that are after this or asking for this. The formal indications are for narcolepsy is the main one, but you know, certainly seen it prescribed off-label, often at patient request for the brain-stimulating effects.
Really?
But it's contraindicated in pregnancy, and contraception and conception and pre-treatment screening guidelines have been updated in New Zealand formulary. So this includes the pre-treatment screening should be blood pressure ECG and excluding pregnancy prior to prescribing, and effective contraception is recommended during treatment and for 2 months after stopping treatment.
Another one of those.
One of those ones. And effective, but coupled with that, effectiveness of hormonal contraception, including the contraceptive pills, implants, injectables, and hormone-releasing IUDs may be reduced. So it all sounded quite scary of what you do for these patients that mustn't become pregnant, but the pill's not going to work particularly effectively for them. And I've just put a link into the UK FSRH guidance, which is by far the best available on contraceptive options in patients taking this drug, which is an enzyme inducer, and other enzyme inducers. And in fact, they are of the opinion that the implants, most implants, Depo-Provera and Mirena are fine to use in this situation.
Right. And presumably it's belt and braces, you know, use a condom as well.
Yeah. Two forms are ideal. But so just certainly if you're asked to prescribe modafinil or in the habit of prescribing modafinil, just remember the pregnancy related issues.
Is modafinil related at all to sildenafil? Because I saw there's a something about Viagra being associated with the reduction in Alzheimer's disease as well.
Interesting. I mean, it sounds as though it might be related. I'm not sure quite, unless it's improving blood supply to the brain, how the
One for another snippets, perhaps, Dave.
I'll investigate that one. Number six, this is vitally important research on Frank's sign. So this is from issue 111 of Cardiology Research Review, which looks at a Spanish study which examined Frank's sign. So Frank's sign, named after Sanders T. Frank, who I think he was a, I think he might have been a gastroenterologist. Anyway, he was some physician in 1973. So linking Frank's sign and cardiovascular risk.
This
Frank,
is getting very weird.
what's even weirder is the photo in the study, which illustrates Frank's sign with some very hairy ears. But Frank's sign is a diagonal earlobe crease,
Yes,
and
of course it is.
I've just put an illustration of this for anyone that's able to watch. And you'll need to go and check yours out now. I checked mine out, and I think mine are okay. But anyway. So Frank's sign is a diagonal earlobe crease. The estimated cardiovascular mortality risk was significantly higher in individuals who presented diagonal earlobe creases, so positive Frank's sign. The number of individuals with moderate, high, or very high cardiovascular risk increased significantly as the presence of the crease increased. So in those range, this moderate, high, or very high cardiovascular risk, 23% had no crease. Around 36% had unilateral creases and 58% had bilateral creases. And the mean cardiovascular risk estimated was significantly higher for individuals with the longest and deepest diagonal earlobe creases and with what's called accessory creases. So the conclusion was the diagonal earlobe creases independently associated with higher cardiovascular risk scores, especially when the crease is complete, bilateral, deep, and has accessory creases. What I couldn't quite understand is whether they looked at age, because your crease does deepen with age because your connective tissues kind of collapse. So I couldn't quite figure whether the depth of the crease and increase in cardiovascular risk was purely related to age increasing the depth of the crease and therefore cardiovascular risk, or whether it was an independent factor.
And sorry, what's the what? Why would this be? Why would having a crease in your earlobe increase your risk of cardiovascular?
There was no pathophysiological theory put out there, but I presume it's a genetic, some sort of genetic association. Whatever gene gives you the crease somehow is tied up with some factor of cardiovascular risk.
My wife was telling me over the weekend that it's only 1% of people can bring their index finger and their little finger together across their palm. I can't do it, and I was wondering if can you do it?
Across the palm, not across behind the fingers.
No, across the I
I can do
can't do
it.
it. You
You
I
can't do
can't do
it.
it. No.
Oh, okay.
And I was wondering if that was linked to any sort of disease as well. People can Why did this gastroenterologist start looking at people's ears in such detail? I'm not sure it's going to be very useful on a day-to-day basis.
Well, I think if you've got somebody that you note when you're looking in their ears, they've got significant creases, you might want to do a cardiovascular risk assessment to see, where they're at.
No, that's true. That
It's an
is
out
true.
it's an
Now,
out of note.
now you've raised it. I'm going to be looking at people's earlobes with much more detail.
Out of interest as much as anything else. But finishing off on probably a more serious note, this just arises from a case I looked at recently of the limping adolescent, and really just a reminder of these things we keep in the depths of our mind. The message really is beware the child with an unexplained limp or knee pain. So just looking at a case recently of misdiagnosis of slipped upper femoral epiphysis, or SUFE. And this was a slim 11-year-old female, which is not your typical presenting patient, but it had disastrous consequences for her when a stable mild slip, which in hindsight she'd had for a couple of months, converted to a severe acute slip and basically ruined her hip joint for life, essentially. So Health Pathways, interestingly, has a section devoted entirely to SUFE, partly because of the severe consequences of a missed or late diagnosis. And it includes the practice point, all children complaining of knee pain need exclusion of hip pathology. So that's fine. I think we all realize that pain radiating to the knee often comes from the hip. But they say if there's no evidence of knee pathology on examination, arrange a hip X-ray with AP pelvis and frog lateral view. However, if you suspect an acute SUFI on the basis of the history and examination alone, don't refer for radiology. Refer immediately for orthopedic assessment rather than imaging. So just as a quick refresher, SUFI, it usually occurs in the 8 to 15-year age group, more common in males, and more than half of sufferers are overweight or obese. It most commonly presents with a chronic slip with gradual movement of the epiphysis, and the patient might present with vague chronic or intermittent aching, pain in the hip, groin, thigh, or medial knee. And about 15% of patients only have thigh or knee pain, but the pain tends to worsen with physical activity, and there's usually no preceding trauma. In this case, the patient had preceding trauma, which further kind of distracted, I think, from the true underlying diagnosis. It may be bilateral in a significant number of cases, up to 50%, but an acute slip presents really after a sudden event with inability to weight bear and more like a hip fracture. More severe pain, reduced internal rotation. And you can get an acute slip on a background of a chronic slip, which occurred in this case, but that can be also intermittent. So it can be sudden exacerbation of symptoms in a setting of more consistent low-grade symptoms, which may be episodic.
Just a nightmare, hey?
A nightmare. But
Yeah.
your chronic slip quite often presents with persistent or episodic limp. And that's where I think the advice is, if you've got a limping adolescent without a clear diagnosis, just be careful to consider SUFI. The foot on the affected side often is slightly outturned with the gait, and there can be loss of internal rotation at the hip and possibly some leg length shortening as well. But one sign that seems to be quite sensitive is when you're passively flexing the hip to 90 degrees, the thigh abducts and rolls into a bit of external rotation compared with the unaffected side.
Right.
So what they say is, look, examine the knee to rule out local processes at the knee to account for knee pain. Do the thigh or hip flexion to check for any subtle abduction or external rotation. With an acute slip, there's usually a marked limp and Trendelenburg gait, and often an inability to weight bear, so it's a bit more straightforward. And there may be an external rotational deformity of the hip and shortening of the affected leg. Problem is, while SUFI is, I think, one of the most common causes of hip pathology in adolescents, it's actually very uncommon. So the annual incidence in the 0 to 16-year age group is around 5 per 100,000, meaning about 40 to 50 cases in New Zealand annually. So we may never see one. I think I've only ever seen two in my whole general practice career.
Yeah.
And a big Australian study a few years ago suggested that the delayed diagnosis of weeks to years occurs in around 60% of cases of chronic stable slip. And most patients, around 76%, present initially to their GP. So delayed diagnosis, very common, but potentially quite disastrous for the patient. So just one to, I guess, keep in that brain somewhere.
Really interesting that 18 to 50% bilateral as well. So if I would think more about an inflammatory condition in a bilateral knee pain than I would think about SUFI, I think. And yeah, I have also seen, I think I certainly remember one case in my GP career so far. And yeah, it wasn't a great outcome.
So I think just keep it in the back of your mind. Limp, adolescent limp equals put SUFI somewhere in the differential. That's the bottom line,
Yeah,
I
but
guess.
I also think that the if you're thinking Sufi, then refer as
Yeah.
well. I if you're thinking Sufi and you're organizing an X-ray and pelvis and frog lateral view, then certainly around New Zealand, in most places, you're going to wait for a week for that X-ray to happen. And if you're thinking Sufi, why are you waiting?
And I think also if you just order a standard hip X-ray, that is not
It's
as
not going
specific or sensitive as the frog view. So early, very subtle SUFIs can be missed on the plain standard hip X-ray.
Yeah. I mean, I think I would take the same attitude to doing that as I would for organizing a troponin. in primary care? Why are you, if you're thinking that you need a result of a troponin, then why are you keeping the patient in the community?
Chase it, make sure you
Yeah.
tag it or something.
Yeah.
Yep, so that's it for today. A bit of ears, hips, equitable prescribing, heart and head
Yeah.
concussion.
And a lot about medication supply.
Yes, sorry, that was.
No, that's great. It's really good, Dave. Thank you so much. Again, absolutely stunning amount of work that goes into these, and I know that it's really appreciated by our listeners, the work that you put in. And the just a reminder that the written notes are available through the Pinnacle website. And yeah, please like and subscribe the podcast.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks for listening. Please like and share this podcast if you found it useful. The show notes on the podcast website contain links to all the resources that we discussed. A video version of this podcast is available on the Pinnacle Practice website at pinnacle.co.nz. Ka kite anō.